stalk that held him. Immediately in front were bowed backs, and tough, thick legs going up and down, unresting, as if they were made of wire and horn, beating out the nightmare seconds of an endless time. In the afternoon, Ugluk's troop overtook the northerners. They were flagging in the rays of the bright sun, winter sun shining in a pale, cool sky though it was. Their heads were down and their tongues lolling out.
"Maggots!" jeered the Isengarders. "You're cooked! The white skins will catch you and eat you! They're coming!"
A cry from Grishnak showed that this was not mere jest. Horsemen, riding very swiftly, had indeed been sighted, still far behind, but gaining on the orcs, gaining on them like a tide over the flats on folk straying in quicksand. The Isengarders began to run with a redoubled pace that astonished Pippin, a terrific spurt, it seemed, for the end of a race. Then he saw that the sun was sinking, falling behind the misty mountains. Shadows reached over the land. The soldiers of Mordor lifted their heads and also began to put on speed. The forest was dark and close. Already they had passed a few outlying trees. The land was beginning to slope upwards ever more steeply, but the orcs didn't halt. Both Ugluk and Grishnak shouted, spurring them on to a last effort.
"They'll make it yet! They'll escape!" thought Pippin. And then he managed to twist his neck so as to glance back with one eye over his shoulder.
He saw that riders away eastward were already level with the orcs, galloping over the plain. The sunset gilded their spears and helmets and glinted in their pale, flowing hair. They were hemming the orcs in, preventing them from scattering, and driving them along over the line of the river. He wondered very much what kind of folk they were. He wished now that he had learned more in Rivendell, and looked more at maps and things. But in those days the plans for the journey seemed to be in more competent hands, and he'd never reckoned with being cut off from Gandalf or from Strider, and even from Frodo. All that he could remember about Rohan was that Gandalf's horse, Shadowfax, had come from that land. That sounded hopeful as far as it went.
"But how will they know that we're not orcs?" he thought. "I don't suppose they've ever heard of hobbits down here. I suppose I ought to be glad that the beastly orcs look like being destroyed, but I'd rather be saved myself."
The chances were that he and Merry would be killed together with their captors before even the men of Rohan were aware of them. A few of the riders appeared to be bowmen, skilled at shooting from a running horse. Riding swiftly into range, they shot arrows at the orcs that straggled behind, and several of them fell. Then the riders wheeled away out of the range of the answering bows of their enemies, who shot wildly, not daring to talk. This happened many times, and on one occasion arrows fell among the Isengarders. One of them, just in front of Pippin, stumbled and did not get up again. Night came down without the riders closing in for battle. Many orcs had fallen, but fully 200 remained. In the early darkness the orcs came to a hillock. The eaves of the forest were very near, probably no more than 3 furlongs away, but they could go no further. The horsemen had encircled them. A small band disobeyed Ugluk's command and ran on towards the forest. Only 3 returned.
"Well, here we are," sneered Grishnak. "Fine leadership. I hope the great Ugluk will lead us out again."
"Put those halflings down," ordered Ugluk, taking no notice of Grishnak. "You, Lugdush, get 2 others and stand guard over them. They're not to be killed unless the filthy whiteskins break through, understand? As long as I'm alive, I want them. But they're not to cry out, and they're not to be rescued. Bind their legs."
The last part of the order was carried out mercilessly, but Pippin found that for the first time he was close to Merry. The orcs were making a great deal of noise, shouting and clashing their weapons, and the hobbits managed to whisper together for a while.
"I don't think much of this," said Merry. "I feel nearly done in. Don't think I could crawl away far, even if I was free."
"Lembas," whispered Pippin,
"Limbus, I've got some. Have you? I don't think they've taken anything but our swords." "Yes, I had a packet in my pocket," answered Merry. "But it must be better to crumbs. Anyway, I can't put my mouth in my pocket."
"You won't have to, I've..."
But just then a savage kick warned Pippin that the noise had died down, and the guards were watchful. The night was dark and cold. All round the knoll on which the orcs were gathered, little watchfires sprang up, gold and red in the darkness, a complete ring of them. They were within a long bowshot, but the riders didn't show themselves against the light, and the orcs wasted many arrows shooting at the fires until a Glück stopped them. The riders made no sound. Later in the night, when the moon came out of the mist, then occasionally they could be seen, shadowy shapes that glinted now and again in the white light as they moved in ceaseless patrol.
"They'll wait for the sun, curse them," growled one of the guards. "Why don't we get together and charge through? What's old O'Glook think he's doing, I should like to know?" "I dare say you would," snarled O'Glook, stepping up from behind. "Meaning, I don't think at all, eh? Curse you! You're as bad as the other rebel, the maggots and the apes of Lugmoors. No good trying to charge with them. They just squeal and bolt, and there are more than enough of these filthy horse-boys to mop up our lot on the flat. There's only one thing those maggots can do. They can see like gimlets in the dark. But these white-skins have better night-eyes than most men, from all I've heard. And don't forget their horses. They can see the night-breeze, or so it's said. Still, there's one thing the fine fellows don't know. Mahor and his lads are in the forest, and they should turn up any time now." O'Glook's words were enough, apparently, to satisfy the Isengarders, but the other orcs were both dispirited and rebellious. They posted a few watchers, but most of them lay on the ground, resting in the pleasant darkness. It did indeed become very dark again, for the moon passed westward into thick cloud, and Pippin could not see anything a few feet away. The fires brought no light to the hillock. The riders were not, however, content merely to wait for the dawn and let their enemies rest. A sudden outcry on the east side of the knoll showed that something was wrong. It seemed that some of the men had ridden in close, slipped off their horses, crawled to the edge of the camp, and killed several orcs, and then had faded away again. O'Glook dashed off to stop a stampede. Pippin and Merry sat up. Their guards, Isengarders, had gone with O'Glook. But if the hobbits had any thought of escape, it was soon dashed. A long, hairy arm took each of them by the neck and drew them close together. Dimly they were aware of Grishnak's great head and hideous face between them. His foul breath was on their cheeks. He began to paw them and feel them. Pippin shuddered as hard, cold fingers groped down his back.
"Well, my little ones," said Grishnak in a soft whisper, "enjoying a nice rest or not? A little awkwardly placed, perhaps. Swords and whips on one side and nasty spears on the other. Little people shouldn't meddle in affairs that are too big for them." His fingers continued to grope. There was a light like a pale but hot fire behind his eyes. The thought came suddenly into Pippin's mind, as if caught direct from the urgent thought of his enemy.
"Grishnak knows about the ring. He's looking for it, while O'Glook is busy. He probably wants it for himself."
Cold fear was in Pippin's heart, yet at the same time he was wondering what use he could make of Grishnak's desire.
"I don't think you'll find it that way," he whispered. "It isn't easy to find."
"Find it?" said Grishnak. His fingers stopped crawling and gripped Pippin's shoulder. "Find what? What are you talking about, little one?"
For a moment Pippin was silent. Then suddenly in the darkness he made a noise in his throat.
"Gollum, Gollum."
"Nothing, my precious," he added.
The hobbits felt Grishnak's fingers twitch.
"Oh, ho," hissed the goblin softly. That's what he means, is it? Oh-ho! Very, very dangerous, my little ones.
Perhaps, said Merry, now alert and aware of Pippin's guess.
Perhaps, and not only for us. Still, you know your business best. Do you want it or not? And what would you give for it?
Do I want it? Do I want it? Said Grishnak, as if puzzled, but his arms were trembling. What would I give for it? What do you mean?
We mean, said Pippin, choosing his words carefully, that it's no good groping in the dark. We could save you time and trouble. But you must untie our legs first, or we'll do nothing and say nothing.
My dear tender little fools, hissed Grishnak, everything you have and everything you know will be got out of you in due time, everything. You'll wish there was more than you could tell to satisfy the questioner, and indeed you will, quite soon. We shan't hurry the inquiry. Oh, dear, no. What do you think you've been kept alive for? My dear little fellows, please believe me when I say that it wasn't out of kindness. That's not even one of Ugluk's faults.
I find it quite easy to believe, said Merry. But you haven't got your prey home yet, and it doesn't seem to be going your way, whatever happens. If we come to Isengard, it won't be the great Grishnak that benefits. Saruman will take all that he can find. If you want anything for yourself, now's the time to do a deal. Grishnak began to lose his temper. The name of Saruman seemed specially to enrage him. Time was passing, and the disturbance was dying down. Ugluk or the Isengarders might return at any minute.
"Have you got it, either of you?" he snarled.
"Gollum, Gollum," said Pippin.
"Untie our legs," said Merry. They felt the orc's arms trembling violently.
"Curse you, you filthy little vermin," he hissed. "Untie your legs. I'll untie every string in your bodies. Do you think I can't search you to the bones? Search you? I'll cut you both to quivering shreds. I don't need the help of your legs to get you away and have you all to myself."
Suddenly he seized them. The strength in his long arms and shoulders was terrifying. He tucked them one under each armpit and crushed them fiercely to his sides. A great stifling hand was clapped over each of their mouths. Then he sprang forward, stooping low. Quickly and silently he went, until he came to the edge of the knoll. There, choosing a gap between the watchers, he passed like an evil shadow out into the night, down the slope and away westward towards the river that flowed out of the forest. In that direction there was a wide open space with only one fire. After going a dozen yards he halted, peering and listening. Nothing could be seen or heard. He crept slowly on, bent almost double. Then he squatted and listened again. Then he stood up, as if to risk a sudden dash. At that very moment the dark form of a rider loomed up right in front of him. A horse snorted and reared. A man called out. Grishnak flung himself on the ground flat, dragging the hobbits under him. Then he drew his sword. No doubt he meant to kill his captives, rather than allow them to escape or to be rescued. But it was his undoing. The sword rang faintly, and glinted a little in the light of the fire away to his left. An arrow came whistling out of the gloom. It was aimed with skill, or guided by fate, and it pierced his right hand. He dropped the sword and shrieked. There was a quick beat of hoofs, and even as Grishnak leapt up and ran, he was ridden down, and a spear passed through him. He gave a hideous shivering cry and lay still. The hobbits remained flat on the ground, as Grishnak had left them. Another horseman came riding swiftly to his comrade's aid. Whether because of some special keenness of sight, or because of some other sense, the horse lifted and sprang lightly over them, but its rider did not see them, lying covered in their elven cloaks, too crushed for the moment, and too afraid to move.
At last Merry stirred and whispered softly, "So far so good. But how are we to avoid being spitted?" The answer came almost immediately. The cries of Grishnak had roused the orcs. From the yells and screeches that came from the knoll, the hobbits guessed that their disappearance had been discovered. Ugluk was probably knocking off a few more heads. Then suddenly the answering cries of orc voices came from the right, outside the circle of watchfires, from the direction of the forest and the mountains. Mahua had apparently arrived and was attacking the besiegers. There was the sound of galloping horses. The riders were drawing in their ring close round the knoll, risking the orc arrows, so as to prevent any sortie, while a company rode off to deal with the newcomers. Suddenly Merry and Pippin realized that without moving they were now outside the circle. There was nothing between them and escape.
"Now," said Merry, "if only we had our legs and hands free, we might get away. But I can't touch the knots, and I can't bite them."
"No need to try," said Pippin. "I was going to tell you. I've managed to free my hands. These loops are only left for show. You'd better have a bit of lembas first."
He slipped the cords off his wrists and fished out a packet. The cakes were broken, but good, still in their leaf wrappings. The hobbits each ate two or three pieces. The taste brought back to them the memory of fair faces and laughter and wholesome food in quiet days now far away. For a while they ate thoughtfully, sitting in the dark, heedless of the cries and sounds of battle nearby. Pippin was the first to come back to the present.
"We must be off," he said. "Half a moment."
Grishnak's sword was lying close at hand, but it was too heavy and clumsy for him to use, so he crawled forward, and finding the body of the goblin, he drew from its sheath a long, sharp knife. With this he quickly cut their bonds.
"Now for it," he said. "When we've warmed up a bit, better we shall be able to stand again and walk. But in any case, we'd better start by crawling."
They crawled. The turf was deep and yielding, and that helped them, but it seemed a long, slow business. They gave the watchfire a wide berth and wormed their way forward bit by bit until they came to the edge of the river, gurgling away in the black shadows under its deep banks. Then they looked about. The sounds had died away. Evidently, Mohor and his lads had been killed or driven off. The riders had returned to their silent, ominous vigil. It wouldn't last very much longer. Already the night was old. In the east, which had remained unclouded, the sky was beginning to grow pale.
"We must get under cover," said Pippin, "or we shall be seen."
"It'll not be any comfort to us if these riders discover that we're not orcs after we're dead." He got up and stamped his feet. "Those cords have cut me like wires, but my feet are getting warm again. I could stagger on now.
What about you, Merry?"
Merry got up.
"Yes," he said, "I can manage it. Lembas does put heart into you, a more wholesome sort of feeling, too, than the heat of the orc draught. I wonder what it was made of.
Better not to know, I expect. Let's get a drink of water to wash away the thought of it."
"Not here. The banks are too steep," said Pippin. "Forward now."
They turned and walked side by side slowly along the line of the river. Behind them the light grew in the east. As they walked they compared notes, talking lightly in hobbit fashion of the things that had happened since their capture. No listener would have guessed from their words that they had suffered cruelly and been in dire peril, going without hope towards torment and death, or that even now, as they well knew, they had little chance of ever finding friend or safety again.
"You seem to have been doing well, Master Took," said Merry. "You will get almost a chapter in old Bilbo's book, if ever I get a chance to report to him. Good work, especially guessing that hairy villain's little game, and playing up to him. But I wonder if anyone will ever pick up your trail and find that brooch. I should hate to lose mine, but I'm afraid yours has gone for good."
"I shall have to brush up my toes if I'm to get level with you. Indeed, Cousin Brandybuck is going in front now.
"This is where he comes in. I don't suppose you've much notion where we are, but I spent my time at Rivendell rather better. We're walking west along the Entwash. The butt end of the mountains is in front, and Fangorn Forest." Even as he spoke, the dark edge of the forest loomed up straight before them. Night seemed to have taken refuge under its great trees, creeping away from the coming dawn.
"Lead on, Master Brandybuck," said Pippin, "or lead back. We have been warned against Fangorn, but one so knowing will not have forgotten that."
"I haven't," answered Merry, "but the forest seems better to me all the same than turning back into the middle of a battle." He led the way in under the huge branches of the trees. Old beyond guessing, they seemed. Great trailing beards of lichen hung from them, blowing and swaying in the breeze. Out of the shadows the hobbits peeped, gazing back down the slope, little furtive figures that in the dim light looked like elf children in the deeps of time, peering out of the wild wood in wonder at their first dawn. Far over the great river and the brown lands, leagues upon grey leagues away, the dawn came, red as flame. Loud rang the hunting horns to greet it. The riders of Rohan sprang suddenly to life. Horn answered horn again. Merry and Pippin heard, clear in the cold air, the neighing of war horses and the sudden singing of many men. The sun's limb was lifted, an arc of fire above the margin of the world. Then with a great cry the riders charged from the east. The red light gleamed on mail and spear. The orcs yelled and shot all the arrows that remained to them. The hobbits saw several horsemen fall, but their line held on up the hill and over it, and wheeled round and charged again. Most of the raiders that were left alive then broke and fled, this way and that, pursued one by one to the death. But one band, holding together in a black wedge, drove forward resolutely in the direction of the forest. Straight up the slope they charged, towards the watchers. Now they were drawing near, and it seemed certain that they would escape. They'd already hewn down three riders that barred their way.
"We've watched too long," said Merry. "There's a Glück. I don't want to meet him again."
The hobbits turned and fled deep into the shadows of the wood. So it was that they did not see the last stand when a Glück was overtaken and brought to bay at the very edge of Fangorn. There he was slain at last by Eomer, the third marshal of the Mark, who dismounted and fought him sword to sword. And over the wide fields the keen-eyed riders hunted down the few orcs that had escaped and still had strength to fly. Then, when they had laid their fallen comrades in a mound and had sung their praises, the riders made a great fire and scattered the ashes of their enemies. So ended the raid, and no news of it came ever back, either to Mordor or to Isengard. But the smoke of the burning rose high to heaven and was seen by many watchful eyes. Chapter 4 Treebeard. Meanwhile the hobbits went with as much speed as the dark and tangled forest allowed, following the line of the running stream, westward and up towards the slopes of the mountains, deeper and deeper into Fangorn. Slowly their fear of the orcs died away, and their pace slackened. A queer stifling feeling came over them, as if the air were too thin or too scanty for breathing. At last Merry halted.
"We can't go on like this," he panted. "I want some air."
"Let's have a drink at any rate," said Pippin. "I'm parched."
He clambered on to a great tree root that wound down into the stream, and stooping, drew up some water in his cupped hands. It was clear and cold, and he took many draughts. Merry followed him. The water refreshed them, and seemed to cheer their hearts. For a while they sat together on the brink of the stream, dabbling their sore feet and legs, and peering round at the trees that stood silently about them, rank upon rank, until they faded away into grey twilight in every direction.
"I suppose you haven't lost us already," said Pippin, leaning back against the great tree trunk. "We can at least follow the course of this stream, the Entwash, or whatever you call it,
and get out again the way we came.
We could if our legs would do it, said Mary, and if we could breathe properly.
Yes, it's all very dim and stuffy in here, said Pippin. It reminds me somehow of the old room in the great place of the Tooks, away back in the Smiles of Tuckborough, a huge place where the furniture has never been moved or changed for generations. They say the old Took lived in it year after year, while he and the room got older and shabbier together, and it has never changed since he died, a century ago. And old Gerontius was my great-great-grandfather. That puts it back a bit. But that is nothing to the old feeling of this wood. Look at all those weeping, trailing beards and whiskers of lichen. And most of the trees seem to be half covered with ragged, dry leaves that have never fallen. Untidy. I can't imagine what spring would look like here. If it ever comes, still less a spring cleaning.
But the sun at any rate must peep in sometimes, said Mary. It doesn't look or feel at all like Bilbo's description of Mirkwood. That was all dark and black, and the home of dark black things. This is just dim and frightfully treeish. You can't imagine animals living here at all, or staying for long.
No, nor hobbits, said Pippin, and I don't like the thought of trying to get through it either. Nothing to eat for 100 miles, I should guess. How are our supplies?
Lo, said Mary. We ran off with nothing but a couple of spare packets of lembas, and left everything else behind. They looked at what remained of the elven cakes. Broken fragments for about 5 meagre days, that was all. And not a wrap or a blanket, said Mary. We shall be cold tonight whichever way we go.
Well, we'd better decide on the way now, said Pippin. The morning must be getting on.
Just then they became aware of a yellow light that had appeared, some way further on into the wood. Shafts of sunlight seemed suddenly to have pierced the forest roof.
Hallo, said Mary. The sun must have run into a cloud while we've been under these trees, and now she's run out again, or else she's climbed high enough to look down through some opening. It isn't far. Let's go and investigate.
They found it was further than they thought. The ground was rising steeply still, and it was becoming increasingly stony. The light grew broader as they went on, and soon they saw that there was a rock wall before them, the side of a hill, or the abrupt end of some long route thrust out by the distant mountains. No trees grew on it, and the sun was falling full on its stony face. The twigs of the trees at its foot were stretched out stiff and still, as if reaching out to the warmth. Where all had looked so shabby and grey before, the wood now gleamed with rich browns and with the smooth black greys of bark like polished leather. The boles of the trees glowed with a soft green like young grass. Early spring or a fleeting vision of it was about them. In the face of the stony wall there was something like a stair, natural perhaps, and made by the weathering and splitting of the rock, for it was rough and uneven. High up, almost level with the tops of forest trees, there was a shelf under a cliff. Nothing grew there but a few grasses and weeds at its edge, and one old stump of a tree with only 2 bent branches left. It looked almost like the figure of some gnarled old man standing there, blinking in the morning light.
"Up we go," said Mary joyfully. "Now for a breath of air and a sight of the land."
They climbed and scrambled up the rock. If the stair had been made, it was for bigger feet and longer legs than theirs. They were too eager to be surprised at the remarkable way in which the cuts and sores of their captivity had healed and their vigour had returned. They came at length to the edge of the shelf, almost at the feet of the old stump. Then they sprang up and turned round with their backs to the hill, breathing deep and looking eastward. They saw that they had only come 3 or 4 miles into the forest. The heads of the trees marched down the slope towards the plain. There, near the fringe of the forest, tall spires of curling black smoke went up, waving and floating towards them.
"The wind's changing," said Mary. "It's turned east again. It feels cool up here."
"Yes," said Pippin. "I'm afraid this is only a passing gleam,
and it'll all go grey again. What a pity! This shaggy old forest looks so different in the sunlight. I almost felt I liked the place."
"Almost felt you liked the forest? That's good. That's uncommonly kind of you,"
said a strange voice.
"Turn round and let me have a look at your faces. I almost feel that I dislike you both. But do not let us be hasty. Turn round."
A large, knob-knuckled hand was laid on each of their shoulders, and they were twisted round, gently but irresistibly. Then two great arms lifted them up. They found that they were looking at a most extraordinary face. It belonged to a large, man-like, almost troll-like figure, at least 14 feet high, very sturdy, with a tall head and hardly any neck. Whether it was clad in stuff like green and grey bark, or whether that was its hide, was difficult to say. At any rate, the arms, at a short distance from the trunk, were not wrinkled, but covered with a brown, smooth skin. The large feet had 7 toes each. The lower part of the long face was covered with a sweeping grey beard, bushy, almost twiggy at the roots, thin and mossy at the ends. But at the moment the hobbits noted little but the eyes. These deep eyes were now surveying them, slow and solemn, but very penetrating. They were brown, shot with a green light. Often afterwards Pippin tried to describe his first impression of them. "One felt as if there was an enormous well behind them, filled up with ages of memory and long, slow, steady thinking, but their surface was sparkling with the present, like sun shimmering on the outer leaves of a vast tree or on the ripples of a very deep lake. I don't know. But it felt as if something that grew in the ground, asleep, you might say, or just feeling itself as something between root-tip and leaf-tip, between deep earth and sky, had suddenly waked up, and was considering you with the same slow care that it had given to its own inside affairs for endless years."
"Hum, hum,"
murmured the voice, a deep voice like a very deep woodwind instrument.
"Very odd indeed. Do not be hasty, that is my motto. But if I had seen you before I heard your voices, I liked them, nice little voices. They reminded me of something I cannot remember. If I had seen you before I heard you, I should have just trodden on you, taking you for little orcs, and found out my mistake afterwards. Very odd you are indeed, root and twig, very odd."
Pippin, though still amazed, no longer felt afraid. Under those eyes he felt a curious suspense, but not fear. "Please," he said, "who are you, and what are you?" A queer look came into the old eyes, a kind of wariness. The deep wells were covered over.
"Hum, now," answered the voice. "Well, I am an Ent, or that's what they call me. Yes, Ent is the word. The Ent I am, you might say, in your manner of speaking. Fangorn is my name, according to some. Treebeard others make it. A Treebeard will do."
"An Ent?" said Merry. "What's that? But what do you call yourself? What's your real name?"
"Who, no," replied Treebeard. "Who? Now that would be telling, not so hasty. And I am doing the asking. You are in my country. What are you, I wonder? I cannot place you. You do not seem to come in the old list that I learned when I was young. But that was a long, long time ago, and they may have some new lists. Let me see. How did it go? Learn now the lore of living creatures. First name the four. The Free Peoples, eldest of all, the Elf Children, Dwarf the Delver, dark are his houses, Ent the Earthborn, old as mountains, Man the Mortal, master of horses. Beaver the Builder, Buck the Leaper, Bear Bee Hunter, Boar the Fighter, Hound is Hungry, Hare is Fearful, Eagle in Eyrie, Ox in Pasture, Hart Horn-Crowned, Hawk is Swiftest, Swan the Whitest, Serpent Coldest. How did it go? Rum-tum, rum-tum, rum-ti-tum-tum. It was a long list, but anyway, you do not seem to fit in anywhere.
We always seem to have got left out of the old lists and the old stories, said Merry. Yet we've been about for quite a long time. We're hobbits. Why not make a new line? Said Pippin. Half-grown hobbits, the hole dwellers. Put us in amongst the four, next to man, the big people, and you've got it.
Not bad, not bad, said Treebeard. That would do. So you live in holes, eh? It sounds very right and proper. Who calls you hobbits, though? That does not sound elvish to me. Elves made all the old words. They began it.
Nobody else calls us hobbits. We call ourselves that, said Pippin.
Come now, not so hasty. You call yourselves hobbits? But you should not go telling just anybody. You'll be letting out your own right names if you're not careful.
We aren't careful about that, said Merry. As a matter of fact, I'm a Brandybuck, Merryoddock Brandybuck, though most people call me just Merry. And I'm a Took, Peregrine Took, but I'm generally called Pippin, or even Pip.
But you are hasty folk, I see, said Treebeard. I am honoured by your confidence, but you should not be too free all at once. There are Ents and Ents, you know, or there are Ents and things that look like Ents but ain't, as you might say. I'll call you Merry and Pippin, if you please, nice names, for I am not going to tell you my name, not yet at any rate.
A queer, half-knowing, half-humorous look came with a green flicker into his eyes.
For one thing, it would take a long while. My name is growing all the time, and I've lived a very long, long time, so my name is like a story. Real names tell you the story of the things they belong to in my language, in the old Entis, as you might say. It is a lovely language, but it takes a very long time to say anything in it, because we do not say anything in it unless it is worth taking a long time to say and to listen to. But now...
And the eyes became very bright and present, seeming to grow smaller and almost sharp.
What is going on? What are you doing in it all? I can see and hear... And smell and feel a great deal from this a-la-la-la-la-rumba-commanda-lindo-borumme. Excuse me, that is a part of my name for it. I do not know what the word is in the outside languages. You know, the thing we are on, where I stand and look out on fine mornings and think about the sun and the grass beyond the wood and the horses and the clouds and the unfolding of the world. What is going on? What is Gandalf up to? And these... Burrarum...
He made a deep rumbling noise like a discord on a great organ.
These orcs and young Saruman down at Isengard. I like news, but not too quick now.
There is quite a lot going on, said Merry, and even if we tried to be quick, it would take a long time to tell. But you told us not to be hasty. Ought we to tell you anything so soon? Would you think it rude if we asked what you were going to do with us, and which side you are on? And did you know Gandalf?
Yes, I do know him. The only wizard that really cares about trees, said Treebeard. Do you know him?
Yes, said Pippin sadly. We did. He was a great friend, and he was our guide.
Then I can answer your other questions, said Treebeard. I am not going to do anything with you, not if you mean by that do something to you without your leave. We might do some things together, I don't know about sides. I go my own way, but your way may go along with mine for a while. But you speak of Master Gandalf as if he was in a story that had come to an end.
Yes, we do, said Pippin sadly. The story seems to be going on, but I'm afraid Gandalf has fallen out of it.
Oh, come now, said Treebeard. Oh, well, he paused, looking long at the hobbits. Well, I do not know what to say. Come now.
If you would like to hear more, said Merry, we will tell you. But it'll take some time. Wouldn't you like to put us down? Couldn't we sit here together in the sun while it lasts? You must be getting tired of holding us up.
Tired? No, I am not tired. I do not easily get tired, and I do not sit down. I am not very, bendable. But there, the sun is going in. Let us leave this. Did you say what you call it?
Hill? Suggested Pippin. Shelf? Step? Suggested Merry.
Treebeard repeated the words thoughtfully. Hill. Yes, that was it. But it is a hasty word for a thing that has stood here ever since this part of the world was shaped. Never mind, let us leave it and go.
Where shall we go? Asked Merry.
To my home, or one of my homes, answered Treebeard.
Is it far?
I do not know. You might call it far, perhaps, but what does that matter?
Well, you see, we've lost all our belongings, said Merry. We have only a little food.
Oh, whom you need not trouble about that, said Treebeard. I can give you a drink that will keep you green and growing for a long, long while. And if we decide to part company, I can set you down outside my country at any point you choose. Let us go.
Holding the hobbits gently but firmly, one in the crook of each arm, Treebeard lifted up first one large foot and then the other, and moved them to the edge of the shelf. The root-like toes grasped the rocks. Then, carefully and solemnly, he stalked down from step to step and reached the floor of the forest. At once he set off with long, deliberate strides through the trees, deeper and deeper into the wood, never far from the stream, climbing steadily up towards the slopes of the mountains. Many of the trees seemed asleep, or as unaware of him as of any other creature that merely passed by. But some quivered, and some raised up their branches above his head as he approached. All the while, as he walked, he talked to himself in a long-running stream of musical sounds. The hobbits were silent for some time. They felt, oddly enough, safe and comfortable, and they had a great deal to think and wonder about. At last Pippin ventured to speak again.
"Please, Treebeard," he said, "could I ask you something? Why did Celeborn warn us against your forest? He told us not to risk getting entangled in it.
Did he know? Rumbled Treebeard. And I might have said much the same if you had been going the other way. Do not risk getting entangled in the woods of Laurel in Dornan. That is what the elves used to call it, but now they make the name shorter. Lothlorien, they call it. Perhaps they are right. Maybe it is fading, not growing. Land of the Valley of Singing Gold, that was it once upon a time. Now it is the Dream Flower. Oh, well. But it is a queer place, and not for just anyone to venture in. I am surprised that you ever got out, but much more surprised that you ever got in. That has not happened to strangers for many a year. It is a queer land. And so is this. Folk have come to grief here. Aye, they have to grief. Laurel in Dorinan, Lindel Orendor, Malin Ornelian, Ornemalin, he hummed to himself. They are falling rather behind the world in there, I guess, he said. Neither this country nor anything else outside the Golden Wood is what it was when Celeborn was young. Still, Tareli lomia tumbale morna tumbale tarea lomeanor. That is what they used to say. Things have changed, but it is still true in places.
What do you mean? Said Pippin. What is true?
The trees and the ants, said Treebeard. I do not understand all that goes on myself, so I cannot explain it to you. Some of us are still true ants, and lively enough in our fashion, but many are growing sleepy, going tree-ish, as you might say. Most of the trees are just trees, of course, but many are half awake. Some are quite wide awake, and a few are, well, getting entish. That is going on all the time. When that happens to a tree, you find that some have bad hearts. Nothing to do with their wood. I do not mean that. Why, I knew some good old fellows down the Entwash, gone long ago, alas. They were quite hollow. Indeed, they were falling all to pieces, but as quiet and sweet-spoken as a young leaf. And there are some trees in the valleys under the mountains, sound as a bell, and bad right through. That sort of thing seems to spread. There used to be some very dangerous parts in this country. There are still some very black patches.
Like the old forest away to the north, do you mean? Asked Mary.
Aye, something like, but much worse. I do not doubt there is some shadow of the great darkness lying there still away north, and bad memories are handed down. But there are hollow dales in this land where the darkness has never been lifted, and the trees are older than I am. Still, we do what we can. We keep off strangers and the foolhardy, and we train and we teach. We walk and we weed. We are tree herds, we old ents. Few enough of us are left now. Sheep get like shepherd, and shepherds like sheep, it is said, but slowly, and neither have long in the world. It is quicker and closer with trees and ents, and they walk down the ages together. For ents are more like elves, less interested in themselves than men are, and better at getting inside other things. And yet again, ents are more like men, more changeable than elves are, and quicker at taking the colour of the outside, you might say, or better than both, for they are steadier and keep their minds on things longer. Some of my kin look just like trees now, and need something great to rouse them, and they speak only in whispers. But some of my trees are limb-lithe, and many can talk to me. Elves began it, of course, waking trees up and teaching them to speak and learning their tree talk. They always wished to talk to everything the old elves did. But then the great darkness came, and they passed away over the sea, or fled into far valleys and hid themselves, and made songs about days that would never come again. Never again. Aye. There was all one wood once upon a time from here to the mountains of Loon, and this was just the east end. Those were the broad days. Time was when I could walk and sing all day and hear no more than the echo of my own voice in the hollow hills. The woods were like the woods of Lothlorien, only thicker, stronger, younger, and the smell of the air. I used to spend a week just breathing.
Treebeard fell silent, striding along, and yet making hardly a sound with his great feet. Then he began to hum again, and passed into a murmuring chant. Gradually the hobbits became aware that he was chanting to them.
In the willow meads of Tazarinan I walked in the spring. Ah, the sight and the smell of the spring in Nantasarion. And I said that was good. I wandered in summer in the elm woods of Osiriand. Ah, the light and the music in the summer by the seven rivers of Osir. And I thought that was best. To the beaches of Neldoreth I came in the autumn. Ah, the gold and the red and the sighing of leaves in the autumn in Tarna Neldor. It was more than my desire. To the pine trees upon the highland of Dorthonion I climbed in the winter. Ah, the wind and the whiteness and the black branches of winter upon Orodnathorn. My voice went up and sang in the sky, and now all those lands lie under the wave. And I walk in Umbarona, in Tauri Morna, in Alda Lome, in my own land, in the country of Fangorn, where the roots are long, and the years lie thicker than the leaves in Tauri Morna Lome.
He ended, and strode on silently, and in all the wood, as far as ear could reach, there was not a sound. The day waned, and dusk was twined about the boles of the trees. At last the hobbits saw, rising dimly before them, a steep, dark land. They had come to the feet of the mountains and to the green roots of tall methedras. Down the hillside the young Entwash, leaping from its springs high above, ran noisily from step to step to meet them. On the right of the stream there was a long slope, clad with grass, now grey in the twilight. No trees grew there, and it was open to the sky. Stars were shining already in lakes between the shores of cloud. Treebeard strode up the slope, hardly slackening his pace. Suddenly before them the hobbit saw a wide opening. Two great trees stood there, one on either side, like living gateposts, but there was no gate save their crossing and interwoven boughs. As the old Ent approached, the trees lifted up their branches, and all their leaves quivered and rustled. For they were evergreen trees, and their leaves were dark and polished, and gleamed in the twilight. Beyond them was a wide level space, as though the floor of a great hall had been cut in the side of the hill. On either hand of the walls sloped upwards, until they were 50 feet high or more, and along each wall stood an aisle of trees that also increased in height as they marched inwards. At the far end the rock wall was sheer, but at the bottom it had been hollowed back into a shallow bay with an arched roof. The only roof of the hall, save the branches of the trees, which at the inner end overshadowed all the ground, leaving only a broad open path in the middle. A little stream escaped from the springs above, and leaving the main water, fell tinkling down the sheer face of the wall, pouring in silver drops, like a fine curtain in front of the arched bay. The water was gathered again into a stone basin in the floor between the trees, and thence it spilled and flowed away beside the open path, out to rejoin the Entwash in its journey through the forest.
Here we are, said Treebeard, breaking his long silence. I have brought you about 70,000 Entstrides, but what that comes to in the measurement of your land I do not know. Anyway, we are near the roots of the last mountain. Part of the name of this place might be Welling Hall, if it were turned into your language. I like it. We will stay here tonight.
He set them down on the grass between the aisles of the trees, and they followed him towards the great arch. The hobbits now noticed that as he walked his knees hardly bent, but his legs opened in a great stride. He planted his big toes, and they were indeed big and very broad, on the ground first, before any other part of his feet. For a moment Treebeard stood under the rain of the falling spring, and took a deep breath. Then he laughed and passed inside. A great stone table stood near, but no chairs. At the back of the bay it was already quite dark. Treebeard lifted two great vessels and stood them on the table. They seemed to be filled with water, but he held his hands over them, and immediately they began to glow, one with a golden and the other with a rich green light, and the blending of the two lights lit the bay, as if the sun of summer was shining through a roof of young leaves. Looking back, the hobbit saw that the trees in the court had also begun to glow, faintly at first, but steadily quickening, until every leaf was edged with light, some green, some gold, some red as copper, while the tree trunks looked like pillars moulded out of luminous stone.
"Well, well, now we can talk again," said Treebeard. "You are thirsty, I expect. Perhaps you are also tired. Drink this."
He went to the back of the bay, and then they saw that several tall stone jars stood there with heavy lids. He removed one of the lids and dipped in a great ladle, and with it filled three bowls, one very large and two smaller ones.
"This is an ent-house," he said, "and there are no seats, I fear, but you may sit on the table."
Picking up the hobbits, he set them on the great stone slab, 6 feet above the ground, and there they sat dangling their legs and drinking in sips.
The drink was like water, indeed very like the taste of the draughts they had drunk from the entwash near the borders of the forest, and yet there was some scent or savour in it which they could not describe. It was faint, but it reminded them of the smell of a distant wood borne from afar by a cool breeze at night. The effect of the draught began at the toes, and rose steadily through every limb, bringing refreshment and vigour as it coursed upwards, right to the tips of the hair. Indeed, the hobbits felt that the hair on their heads was actually standing up, waving and curling and growing. As for Treebeard, he first laved his feet in the basin beyond the arch, and then he drained his bowl at one draught, one long, slow draught. The hobbits thought he would never stop. At last he set the bowl down again.
"Ah," he sighed. "Now we can talk easier. You can sit on the floor, and I will lie down. That will prevent this drink from rising to my head and sending me to sleep."
On the right side of the bay there was a great bed on low legs, not more than a couple of feet high, covered deep in dried grass and bracken. Treebeard lowered himself slowly onto this, with only the slightest sign of bending at his middle, until he lay at full length, with his arms behind his head, looking up at the ceiling, upon which lights were flickering like the play of leaves in the sunshine. Merry and Pippin sat beside him on pillows of grass.
"Now tell me your tale, and do not hurry," said Treebeard.
The hobbits began to tell him the story of their adventures ever since they left Hobbiton. They followed no very clear order, for they interrupted one another continually, and Treebeard often stopped the speaker and went back to some earlier point, or jumped forward asking questions about later events. They said nothing whatever about the ring, and did not tell him why they set out or where they were going to, and he did not ask for any reasons. He was immensely interested in everything, in the Black Riders, in Elrond and Rivendell, in the Old Forest and Tom Bombadil, in the Mines of Moria, and in Lothlorien and Galadriel. He made them describe the Shire and its country over and over again. He said an odd thing at this point.
"You never see any Ents round there, do you?" he asked. "Well, not Ents. Ent-wives, I should really say."
"Ent-wives?" said Pippin. "Are they like you at all?"
"Yes, well, no. I do not really know now," said Treebeard thoughtfully. "But they would like your country, so I just wondered."
Treebeard was, however, especially interested in everything that concerned Gandalf, and most interested of all in Saruman's doings. The hobbits regretted very much that they knew so little about them, only a rather vague report by Sam of what Gandalf had told the council. But they were clear, at any rate, that Ugluk and his troop came from Isengard and spoke of Saruman as their master.
"Hum," said
Treebeard, when at last their story had wound and wandered down to the Battle of the Orcs and the Riders of Rohan.
"Well, well, that is a bundle of news and no mistake. You have not told me all, no indeed, not by a long way. But I do not doubt that you are doing as Gandalf would wish. There is something very big going on, that I can see, and what it is maybe I shall learn in good time or in bad time. by root and twig, but it is a strange business. Up sprout a little folk that are not in the old lists, and behold, the 9 forgotten riders reappear to hunt them, and Gandalf takes them on a great journey, and Galadriel harbours them in Carras Galarthon, and orcs pursue them down all the leagues of Wilderland. Indeed, they seem to be caught up in a great